First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida's Board of Education targets Duval County schools over masks and quarantines, but the district says it might sue the state. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, we've got the latest in the state's war against Florida school districts over how to protect kids from COVID. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with The Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin about her new book, Resistance. But first this hour, in their continuing efforts to pressure school districts over their handling of COVID-19, the State Board of Education has scheduled a meeting next week to look at whether 11 Florida school districts have complied with their rules aimed at preventing student mask mandates. The State Board will meet October 7th and focus on school districts defying them around the state, including Duval County. But the districts are fighting back. The Duval County Public School Board this week authorized their legal team to sue the Florida Department of Health. Now, this dispute is over an emergency rule handed down from the state that requires districts to let parents opt their kids out of mask mandates and also quarantine rules. Claire Heddles has been covering the story for WJCT News, and she joins us now in studio. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Melissa. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you with us. What are your questions about the state battling Florida school districts? We want to hear from parents, teachers, and everyone. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. So, Claire, the State Board of Education has been doing battle for some time now with school districts across Florida, insisting that they let mask mandates go by the wayside. The latest battle is over whether students who are positive for COVID should quarantine at home. They're meeting next week to take further action, I take it, against districts, including Duval County. What can we expect?
So they're meeting next Thursday. They're looking at the 11 school districts that have mask mandates. And they're talking about both emergency rules, one that passed in August that sort of said that there needed to be parent opt-out, but schools have been saying a medical opt-out fits for what that rule said, and then a new rule passed just last week that says very clearly at parents' sole discretion to try to take away any confusion about whether medical opt-out mm-hmm. counts as parent opt-out. So they're looking at whether these 11 school districts have complied with both emergency rules.
Okay, now school districts aren't taking this dispute lying down. This week, Duval County voted, the school board voted 4-3 to authorize suing the Florida Health Department. Can you tell us what happened and how they came to that decision?
So general counsel told the school board Tuesday in this special emergency meeting that was called after Education Commissioner Corcoran told the school board, you need to come into compliance with this new rule saying parents have sole discretion or I will withdraw these funds, which is a threat that he's been making for more than a month now that he hasn't followed through on yet. But he said in his letter, quote, this is your last chance to come into compliance. So general counsel told the school board that they could take legal action against the state based on rulemaking authority. So basically what the attorney said is that the Department of Health only has the authority to pass these emergency rules if they prevent the spread of COVID. And then she said they could challenge it by saying this new rule actually enables the spread of COVID, both with the quarantine requirements, letting parents opt out and parent opt out of mask requirements. So that's one possible grounds that they could file a lawsuit. But what they voted on was to let the legal team both explore options and then also authorize them to move forward with a suit if they decide one of those options is valid. So nothing has been filed yet, and there was some debate during the school board meeting about whether the school board should authorize them to just explore legal options for now and then bring those options before them for a second vote about actually filing the suit. And the legal team said with the time, with the pressure from Commissioner Corcoran, it's most important that we just move as quickly as possible and go ahead and authorize us to file the suit if we decide we want to. And so that's what the school board voted to do, to authorize them to do so, to file this legal action.
Okay. It's 549-2937. So most of the school board members said that this isn't necessarily about the mask mandates and the quarantining, Claire. It's more about setting a marker down that the board wants to send a message about the importance of home rule, local control. That's what this is all about. These districts are saying we should have the authority to decide what's best for our students, our teachers. Individual districts should be able to decide this. It shouldn't be a blanket rule from the state, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly what school board chair Elizabeth Anderson and the other three school board members who voted in favor of authorizing the legal team to take action. They all said the reason they were doing that was in the battle for local control, that the school board should have the authority to make the decisions that are best for the students, and that it shouldn't come from the state level. So what they said specifically is that it's not about masks. It's not about this fight this month. This is about, in the long run, what does this mean for the control we have over our district?
What's ironic about this is that home rule, local control, has typically been a conservative value. But under this governor, we have not seen that.
I think so. I think a lot of the school board members also kind of jumped on that, I think, because they saw it as something that they could connect with a lot of these people in the audience during the school board meeting that were against mask mandates, that were talking about parent choice. And they were appealing to them, telling them, you should care about this. This is about local control. This is a value that you've expressed in the past that you care about, that it's up to your community to take care of your children, not this overarching authority from the state.
Polling done on this around Florida shows a majority of Florida residents approve of letting districts set policy. The majority of Florida residents also approve of letting districts mandate masks to protect children and staff. But that said, there was certainly a vocal minority that let the school board know they didn't like the mask mandate idea. The mandate is set to expire in Duval County, you report, December 5th, depending on the positive test rate. So we are looking at a possible end to this, right?
Right. It could expire as soon as tomorrow and then make all of this sort of negligible. I mean, the school board members said they still care about the local control issue, but we are nearing the threshold that would make it expire. So that threshold is what the Duval County Health Department defines as moderate transmission. So that's less than 8% testing positivity rate, which we are very close to. We're at 8% right now. But also, I believe it's less than 50 cases per 100,000 people. And we're quite far from that. We're at 170 per 100,000 people.
Right. We remain a hotspot. 549-2937. Give us a call. Peter at the Beaches. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
How are you doing?
All right, thanks. Hanging in there. How about you?
Oh, yeah. I'm a little upset, a little annoyed with the state of affairs. I want to know, and this hasn't not come up, but how much money the state of Florida is spending and the governor is spending on all of these lawsuits, whether, you know, initiating them or defending them in court, everything from the riot lawsuit to everything down the road. I mean, how many millions of dollars is being wasted right now on just silliness?
Peter, thanks for that. That question has come up a lot, Claire Heddles. The state has retained attorneys to fight in court on a number of fronts. The anti-riot law, the social media complaint, the battle over school mask mandates. There are others. Attorneys for the governor get paid, I think it's between $500 to $700 an hour. And so I don't think the official tally has been done. But yes, the taxpayers are on the hook to the tune of millions of dollars as the governor engages in these fights. Critics say so that he can better position himself to run for president in 2024. Do we know the exact amount taxpayers are fronting for all of this?
I think that's a great question and something I would definitely also like to know, and maybe we'll look into later, because I also don't know the total number of how much taxpayers have been paying for all of these legal battles from the state. I will say it did come up during the school board members or during the school board meeting on Tuesday from the members that opposed taking legal action. They did bring up the cost of it. They said, we're already defending ourselves as a district from a lawsuit from 18 parents that are suing the district over the mask mandate, that say there shouldn't be a mask mandate. So what the board members were saying on Tuesday that opposed authorizing legal action was that we're already funding this defense lawsuit to now go on the offensive and fund another lawsuit. Is that worth spending district money? And we don't know that exact number yet. That's not something that they could establish during the school board member meeting on Tuesday. But that was a concern that those opposing legal action brought up, too.
Julie tweets the show, the legislature has been wasting taxpayer dollars for years on ridiculous lawsuits. Okay, 549-2937, Dave in Nassau County. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Melissa. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Getting over a cold. Luckily, it's not COVID-19, so I can't complain. Go ahead.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
I was just saying that it appears to me as though the Republican Party is becoming the party of hypocrisy. I mean, Mitch McConnell used the rule to deny President Obama a position on the Supreme Court and then turned around and then confirmed a nominee just at the end of their term. It just seems to me as though you cannot trust anything that any Republican politician says. They just appear to be just pathetically hypocritical. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. Certainly there is a lot of anger over policies in this state around this, but let's give voice to the other side as well, Claire. The district has heard from parents and others who are very upset about the mandates, and they tend to be mostly, not all, but many of them Republican. They see it as an overreach. Let's give voice to that side of the argument, which the district didn't buy, by the way.
Right. On Tuesday's special meeting, there was more than 2 hours of public comment, almost entirely parents opposed to the mask mandate. It was more than 50 parents that attended the meeting. There was very few that were in support of the mask mandate, and almost all of them were giving reasons why they should be able to decide as parents whether or not to mask their children, which the school board really didn't seriously discuss the issues that they brought up during the meeting later. They really talked about, this is the policy we established. We established earlier this month. We voted on it. We agreed on it. This is our policy, and we're not going to change it because the state says we should change it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seriously consider changing it because of what the parents had said just beforehand.
And they're following the science, the recommendations of scientists and public health experts. What about the quarantining piece? The state is now saying that parents should decide whether their child quarantines at home if they test positive for COVID-19. So far, Duval County seems to be going its own way on this too, and telling the state, no, we're going to continue with our protocols.
Well, actually, the superintendent said that we're already in compliance with that portion of it. They said that's actually not something that the district is in conflict with,
okay,
with the state over the quarantine. And that's mostly because they changed their policy on Monday. This past Monday, they issued a new policy that classrooms won't quarantine if there's more than 2 cases. But previously, elementary school classrooms, the whole class would move virtual if there are more than 2 cases in a classroom. On Monday, they said in response to the new emergency rule, we're no longer going to do that. So because of that change, and because the superintendent said the school district doesn't have a formal policy about quarantine, they're following what the County Department of Health does, and therefore the school board is somewhat protected from the state taking action against them regarding the quarantine piece. So it's more so the mask mandate piece that the superintendent thinks that we're in conflict with the state about. She said she believes we're in compliance with the
other piece,
with the quarantine piece.
Chelsea in Putnam County. Hello, Chelsea. Oh, we lost Chelsea. But what she wanted to say was, kids have always had to stay home when they're sick. Why is this any different? You know, I mean, that's a good point. When my kids were in daycare, if they had a fever and if you brought your child to daycare with a fever, they'd call you right away and say, come get the kid. Can't keep them. We're not going to keep them here today. So that's certainly a valid point.
It is a valid point. And I think it does go back to what the attorneys were saying, that the rules only make sense if they are connected to preventing the spread of diseases. If they actually enable the spread of diseases, are they still valid? And that's the argument the attorney is making. And one thing that they talked about quite a bit on Tuesday was that they really are seeing cases going down. We're seeing that countywide, but we're definitely seeing that in the district. In early September, there were more than 300 cases a week. So far this week, there's less than 70. So those that are in support of the mask mandates are saying, look, it's working. Why would we change course now?
Lots of tweets. Here's one from Chris. I am encouraged by the board finally worrying about home rule, although it seems a little late. What about charter and voucher schools, teacher pay, the treatment of LGBT kids, things the state has usurped and the district is turning a blind eye? We should note that this person tweeting the show is a teacher in the Duval schools. Here's a tweet from Susan. The state's Surgeon General has new wacky rules that apply to schools in COVID, but do they apply to charter and voucher-funded private schools? Why is the State Board of Ed only attacking district-run schools?
My understanding is that they don't apply to charter schools.
That's basically correct. And so that also has come under criticism because there isn't a uniform set of rules. At the same time, too, let's talk about the fact that Richard Corcoran is threatening to defund or withdraw salaries indirectly from districts that have defied him on this. That hasn't happened yet, has it?
Right, which is sort of funny that this threat was made more than a month ago. I mean, funny might not be the right word, but a bit odd that the commissioner made this threat at the end of August and said, if you don't come into compliance, we're going to withdraw school board member salaries, which we calculated for Duval is about $22,000. But the federal government has said, we'll step in and give you that money if the state takes it away. So it's not so much a threat, a financial threat, as it is a symbolic threat. But so far, the commissioner has only done that in Alachua County and Broward County and didn't follow through on that threat in Duval or the other districts that have mask mandates. But in his letter last week, he wrote, this is your last chance to come into compliance. And so he might follow through on it now, but it's not clear. It's likely dependent on what happens at next week's hearing with the Board of Education.
These districts defying the state, they make up the bulk of students in Florida. These are large urban school districts that are basically telling the state to pound sand, Claire. They're saying, no, we don't agree with your interpretation of the science. So the majority of Florida school children are living under different rules than what the state wants. That's the reality right now.
It's true. It's true. And Alachua County, Orange County, Broward County all filed a lawsuit earlier this month, filed a legal challenge saying that the previous rule didn't apply to them and that it was created under invalid rulemaking authority. So that legal challenge was dismissed when the new rule took effect last week. So now the question is there going to be another legal challenge? If there is, Duval will likely sign on to it, which they didn't on the previous one.
Ray emails the show, my child will continue to wear a mask, but Catholic schools in Duval, Flagler, and Nassau counties are now mask optional because the positivity rate has dipped below 10%. So lots of kids at other types of schools, mask optional now, we need to note, right?
Mm-hmm. I think even in Duval County, there was some confusion about whether the mandate would be lifted when it reached below 8%, if it needed to meet both of these thresholds, the 50 per 100,000 and the less than 8%. A lot of the parents that spoke on Tuesday said they thought it was going to be lifted when it reached below 8%. Alone, but the superintendent clarified it's both of those measures before Duval is going to lift its mandate.
Okay. And so with all of this said, what can we expect next in this fight? We'll obviously look ahead to the State Board of Education meeting, but what else can we expect?
So The superintendent and Elizabeth Anderson, the school board chair, are set to respond to Commissioner Corcoran today. He sent them a letter last Thursday and told them to respond within 24 hours. They responded and said, we need at least a week to have a school board meeting to discuss this, and we'll let you know by September 30th how we're in compliance or whether or not we're going to come into compliance in the way that you ask. So after the vote on Tuesday, it's likely they're going to write in the letter that we're standing by our mask mandate and we're not going to come into compliance the way that you say we need to. But they haven't sent that letter yet. To my knowledge, we're expecting that. We'll be watching for that later in the day. And that will probably give some light into what the district is thinking. And then, of course, next week, next Thursday, when the Board of Education holds this hearing.
And so if the state follows through and withdraws funds from some of these school districts, including Duval County, Duval County's position may well be, go ahead. If that's the most that you can do to penalize us, we can live with that. Is that the gist of it?
Somewhat. The threats are a bit vague. I mean, it says Commissioner Corcoran says I will move forward with withholding school board members' salaries and take other action as I see necessary. And he hasn't outlined what that action would be, and he hasn't taken additional action against Broward or Alachua counties. So we're not quite clear what that would be. The only one that's sort of explained is the school board member salary part.
We'll continue to follow it. In the meantime, go to WJCT.org for more of Claire's great reporting on this. Claire Heddles of WJCT News. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Much more still ahead, meanwhile. Later in the hour, we've got to look at all of the fun on tap with this weekend's 40th anniversary of the Jacksonville Jazz Festival. Our Shelton Hull will tell us more from the Jacksonville Music Experience. That's later, but up next.
I made the decision to write the book because it was so evident to me that this was a largely women's-led movement.
The Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin on the activism of women in the Trump era. We go inside her new book, Resistance. That's next.
The Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT Public Media is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, profiles of local artists, and more. Turn your ear on the beautiful noise emerging from Northeast Florida and learn more about the local artist whose music is reverberating across the country. Visit jacksmusic.org to play it local and play it loud.
WJCT Public Media is bringing you a new healthcare show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Our goal is to help you navigate all things health and healthcare and get you the answers you deserve. Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9, sponsored in part by American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Norellis.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this Saturday, thousands of activists will gather across the state to call for a continued commitment to reproductive freedom. In our area, they will gather at the Duval County Courthouse for a rally. This is in reaction to the Texas legislature passing the most restrictive abortion legislation in America last month. Activists call it a direct attack on Roe versus Wade. The Florida legislature is looking at passing similar legislation, which would essentially ban abortion in Florida if it were to pass. Now, the rallies and marches Saturday will coincide with marches in Washington, D.C. A number of local groups are taking part in this march Saturday with caravans and a rally, all culminating in speeches at the Duval County Courthouse. This activism is what we're looking at now, the gripping story of the surge in American women's political activism. In the lead up to the 2020 election, women from the suburbs, the cities, young, old, and of all races and backgrounds became organizers, activists, and volunteers. And they stepped up as first-time candidates for office, motivated to follow their own political aspirations. Some ran for president, and one shattered expectations to become vice president. Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin documents this extraordinary era in her new book, Resistance. I spoke with her. Take a listen. Jennifer Rubin, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, your book really sums up a remarkable time in American history, how women reacted so strongly to the election of Donald Trump. And you begin with the Women's March, the largest protest event in American history, and how that was born out of so many women's dismay at Trump's election. Can you tell us a little bit about how you put the book together and you made the decision to begin at that inflection point in American history?
Well, I think I made the decision to write the book because it was so evident to me that this was a largely women's-led movement. The overall resistance, of course, had men. Of course, there were men who voted ultimately for Joe Biden. Of course, there were men who ran for president and other offices. But the degree to which the movement to oust Donald Trump and really the influx of new people who were uniquely and personally motivated to get into politics was really majority women. And I didn't think that that story was being told. And I also felt to a certain extent that I was part of that. The book is as much a story of the women's progression as it is from my flight from the Republican Party, where I was more or less comfortable for most of my adult life. And I thought it was important to tell their story and to give readers some insight into my own. And I start with that terrible evening of election night 2016, sort of the emotional thunderclap that many women felt and reacted to. And although there was an initial sense of despair, of dislocation, of disbelief, of depression, very quickly women began to reach out to one another, to network, to come up with the next thing to do. And there was, even before the Women's March, there were, if you remember, protests that were going to be underway and were being organized against the Muslim ban that was going to be enacted shortly after he was elected. So that and then the Women's March were really the first mm-hmm. demonstrations that this was something different, that this was going to be popular democracy, people in the streets, people making new organizations, people really fighting for what they thought was broader than a specific agenda or specific policy, but really for American democracy itself.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, in your book, Resistance, you interview women from across the political spectrum, many of whom had never been politically inclined. And for the first time, they become motivated to enter the political arena, to volunteer or to run for office themselves, to lead protest events. These are progressive women, moderate women, and women like you who had always typically identified as conservative, but under the Trump presidency did not anymore feel comfortable identifying as Republican. So you mentioned that became you as well. And certainly people who read your column regularly in the Washington Post have followed along with your political evolution. What's it been like since publishing the book and the feedback you're getting from other women who've been on that same kind of path?
Well, it's very interesting. The more I talk to other women and the more I hear back from them, the more I realize that this really is a common story. you speak about people for the first time becoming engaged. That runs all the way from people like Abigail Spanberger and Amy McGrath, who ran for office for the first time in 2018, to women, for example, in Chesterfield County, Virginia, where a group of essentially women bemoaning the election results turns into a network of several thousand people where they vet candidates, they run candidates, they volunteer, they help lift Abigail Spanberger into the House, they help organize for Democrats in the political election. So everywhere I looked, I saw women on this path, and the reaction has really been very much me too, or if it was men have said, you know, this was my mom, this was my wife, this was my sister. So I think it is a common experience that people had. And I hope people who aren't maybe necessarily all that interested in politics would get something out of it too, because it really speaks to a human ability to show resilience, to change one's environment, to make a shift in one's thinking. So I think if people who aren't necessarily spent all their time talking about politics, but are thinking about life changes, are thinking about how they reorient their lives, how they come out of the pandemic, how they deal with all sorts of issues, I think there's something in there for them as well, because it's really a story of how women reinvented their lives in many cases.
Right. The Trump years were transformative for millions of American women of all political persuasions. Now, let me ask you, Jennifer, about the next phase of our politics. You close the book with a wrap-up of what happened on January 6th, the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building. What are your thoughts about the role women and all of us have to play in preserving democracy?
Well, when I wrote the book, I never thought it would be as relevant going forward as it was a summary of the past. Mm-hmm. But of course, defeating Donald Trump didn't mean that we defeated the threats to democracy. And I think to a large extent, even more now, when Donald Trump isn't in office, the very same changes confront American and American women, American voters and American women. And that is, how do we reassert democratic values? How do we create bridges and alliances that go beyond partisan politics to push back against a movement that is irrational in many cases, xenophobic in many cases, and most importantly, anti-democratic in many instances. And that discussion is going on to this day, whether we're talking about voting rights or we're talking about the diabolical scheme in Texas to give a bounty to people who turn in women who are getting abortions. We're seeing it really throughout our current politics. So there was much more continuity after the election than I thought there would be. That's the bad news. The good news is a lot of the lessons of the election, I think, are still valid, which is you have to organize, you have to reach out, you have to be involved. Democracy takes work. It takes citizens to run for office, to volunteer, to give money, to make their voices heard. And so in some sense, we have an advantage that women didn't have back in 2016-17, and that is we have a roadmap. They did this before, and I think we can take out that roadmap and apply it to many of the challenges we're facing now.
Thanks so much for your time. She's Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin. The book is Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Well, the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens is hosting its second annual telethon this weekend. It's billed as an incredible night of animals, special guests, and inspirational stories live from the zoo and broadcast on our news partner, WJXT Virtual Channel 4. Tony Vecchio is executive director of the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens. He's on the line with more about the zoo-a-thon this weekend. Hey, Tony.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, good to talk to you. So people can follow along and watch this coming up, the Zoo-a-thon this weekend. What are we going to enjoy?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's like a day at the zoo without coming to the zoo. We have, I don't know if you saw it last year or not, it was really a wonderful occasion. We have live animals making appearances, special guest stars, and lots of really cool stories about the conservation and education and animal wellness work that's going on here.
Yeah, you know, Tony, the connection is a little sketchy here. I know up on the north side is where you're calling from. So we do apologize for that. Okay, so what will we learn about what's new at the zoo? The zoo, by the way, is over 100 years old. I don't think a lot of people realize that. And there's a lot happening at the zoo.
That is correct. It's the zoo. There's always something new happening here. Every day is exciting. But if you haven't been out here in a while, boy, it's been the animals ignore the fact that we all thought it was a bad year. They had a great time. We had our first baby gorilla in a couple years. We've had three baby giraffes this summer, and our wonderful little group of penguins had three more penguin chick hatch this year. So there's a lot of new animals have joined the family, and there's a lot to do and see.
Can you talk a little bit about your efforts to position the zoo as not just a place to come see the animals, but also a place of education and conservation?
Oh, thank you for noticing that. So many of our visitors just come here for because it's a great, fun family experience, but there's so much more going on here. With all of our education programs, overnight camp, field trips, we service over 100,000 school kids a year participate in activities out here at the zoo. So it's a great conservation education resource for our community. And we're doing conservation work right here in the community as well as all over the world. We have projects going on in South America and Africa, Asia. But right here in our own community, we are the only place in North Florida that has a critical care center for manatees. We rescue injured and cold-stressed manatees and bring them here for rehabilitation and then release them back to the wild. So the conservation mission is really important to us. But the one thing that really makes our zoo unique and special, we are one of only a handful of zoos in North America that have an animal wellness department. We have full-time staff and master's students from UNS that are here studying ways to make life better for animals. And we share that information with other zoos and even conservation organizations that are working around the world. So the things we're learning here about how to make life better for animals.
Better for animals, yeah.
Making life better for animals all over the world.
And Tony, hold that thought. We're going to hang up and try to dial you again and get a slightly better connection when we come back from the break. How everyone can support the Zoo-a-thon this weekend. That's in just a moment here on the show. So keep listening. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
right, let's get back now to Tony Vecchio, Executive Director at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, as we talk about this weekend's second annual Zoo-a-thon, a telethon you can watch and contribute to. Hey, Tony.
Hi.
Oh, you sound much better. Okay.
I wonder. I feel better.
So as we've been talking about the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, which is such a gem in this community, you are a nonprofit organization. So the Zoo-a-thon is an easy way for people to support the zoo. How can people watch and be part of it, and how can they support the zoo?
Well, there's a million ways to support the zoo. I tell you what, just coming here to visit is great. We love when our community visits, and having a membership is a really big help to us. But if you want to be very specific about helping this week, the Zoo-a-thon is on Channel 4 at 6:30 on Sunday. No Jags game to compete with. They won't be playing at that time. And you can call, and it'll be a very entertaining hour for you, but there'll also be an opportunity for you to make donations to help us with our really important mission.
So they just need to turn on our news partner, Channel 4. They can text donate to a phone number that will flash on the screen, correct?
Correct. And if somebody wants to, if you can't watch the Zoo-a-thon, you can go to jacksonvillezoo.org/zoo-a-thon, zoo-a-thon, and make a donation.
Right. Now, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, this will help you at the zoo and gardens care for thousands of animals and about 1,000 plant species and advance your efforts as an education and conservation resource. A portion of every ticket sold goes to dozens of conservation initiatives that you support, not only here in our area, but around the world. So this is a worldwide telethon in that sense, isn't it?
Yes, you can be helping tigers and rhinos in Asia, elephants and rhinos in Africa, our kind of iconic species, the okapi, which we are the world leaders in saving the okapi in Central Africa, and even things you'll never see at the zoo, like giant armadillos in Brazil. We have programs all over the world to help those animals.
For people that haven't been to the zoo in a while, they might be surprised because you're always putting in new exhibits and new attractions. That's something that I noticed when I hadn't come in a long time, and then you come back and you realize this is like a whole new place.
Yeah, way back in 2004, when the zoo opened the Range of the Jaguar, it won an award for the best zoo exhibit in the country. And what that did, which makes my job that much harder, it raised the bar here. So our board and our staff and our community now expect everything we do needs to be that quality. So the last two major exhibits we've opened, the African Forest and the Land of the Tiger, have both won that same award from the Zoo Association, Best Zoo in North America. So we're very proud of the quality of our new exhibits.
Check it out, everybody, at jacksonvillezoo.org and watch the Zoo-a-thon Sunday night on Channel 4. They have a goal of raising $350,000 this year. Watch and donate, follow along on TV, and go visit the zoo sometime. Tony Vecchio, Executive Director at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens. Have fun.
Thank you so much.
That's this weekend, but you know what else is this weekend? The 40th anniversary of the Jacksonville Jazz Festival. We'll take a listen and see what's on tap right after this.
Lee and Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee and Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
WJCT Public Media is bringing you a new healthcare show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Our goal is to help you navigate all things health and healthcare and get you the answers you deserve. Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9. sponsored in part by American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Neurelis.
I'm Marco Werman. We're living through history, and the world's newsroom has the first draft.
I think the thing we have to worry about is the growing anti-American sentiment 20 years after 9/11. That has not gone away. It's only deepened.
Looking for answers and making sense of global events as they happen. Join us on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Stevie Van Zandt formed the E Street Band with Bruce Springsteen, took on apartheid with the song Sun City, starred on The Sopranos. He's got a new memoir out, Hold On To Your Hat or Headscarf. A talk with Little Stevie next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Social media has had few qualms about the need to grow the number of its youngest users. But this week, Instagram pushed pause on plans to develop an app for those under 13. New reporting raised questions about its impact on young kids, but Facebook says the service is not toxic for preteens.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville Jazz Festival is returning to downtown this weekend with free performances at two stages along the St. Johns River and a beautiful fireworks display to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the festival. Shelton Hull is a contributor to our Jacksonville Music Experience, and he's got a preview now on what we can expect. Hey, Shelton, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. It's good to talk to you. So the Jacksonville Jazz Festival weekend is this weekend. Two stages, as I mentioned, and it's hard to believe, but this is the 40th anniversary of this event. Pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. The festival originally began back in 1981 out at Mayport. It was Mayport and all that jazz. And then around 83, I believe it was, the festival moved out to Metro Park, and it was there until I believe 2003 or so. There was no festival in 01 and 02. And so it's been basically in different parts of downtown Jacksonville for the past 20 years, which is a nice way to see downtown on the weekend.
Right. Now, there are some amazing names coming in this weekend. What's caught your eye among all of the people that will be performing?
Well, absolutely. You know, as a old school fan of the festival, I've been to every festival since probably 91. One of the highlights back in the day used to always be George Benson. George is closing things out this year. He's going to be there. We've got the Let's Ride Brass Band. We've got, I'm particularly looking forward to Cecile McLaurin-Savant, who is arguably the best, most popular jazz singer in the world today. And there's a whole lot of stuff going on. I'm particularly thrilled about the Jazz After Dark events. That provides a great spotlight for some of our homegrown local talents. Friday night in particular, you're going to have the Raisin Cake Orchestra at the Volstead. You've got Al Maniscalco's quartet at the Parlor at Grape and Grain. And you've got the Longinus Parsons Group at the Justice Pub. That particular night, in addition to the other things going on related to the festival, I would put that one night of jazz up against anything going on in the world on Friday night.
Absolutely. And two stages, there's the swinging stage, performances there at Riverfront Plaza, the grooving stage at Fort on Bay. We're talking Sheila E., Kenneth Babyface Edmonds, Najee with special guests Phil Perry and Bobby Lyle, many, many more. And as we've mentioned, this is free. This is a free weekend of music in downtown Jacksonville. People need to be aware of stuff like parking restrictions and traffic delays. And this is a cashless festival too, correct, Shelton?
Yes, it is a cashless festival. Bring your debit cards and whatnot. Parking will be kind of a challenge, as it always is with downtown events. I live in Riverside near Five Point, so a lot of us will probably just take the Riverwalk right across, which isn't always an option. You've got bikes, you've got the Skyway, you've got the water taxi. There's no real restrictions on bag size or bag limits, but they will be checking through everything and treat it kind of like you would a football game. You know, don't bring anything too weird. I mean, this is Florida, so you'll probably bring something weird, but not too weird.
Yeah. And to cap it all off, to celebrate the 40th anniversary, Saturday night they're going to shoot up an incredible fireworks display high above the St. John's River between the Main Street Bridge and the Acosta Bridge following Sheila E.'s performance. So that will cap it off. That sounds fun.
That's going to be great. You know, I think a lot of folks are looking to blow off steam. You know, there was no festival last year because of the pandemic. This year's festival, we weren't even certain that it was going to happen until just a couple of months ago. We've already had festivals around the country like Bonnaroo and Coachella and the New Orleans Jazz Festival. All of those have been canceled. So we were very lucky to have this opportunity.
Shelton Hull, he writes at our Jacksonville Music Experience, jacksmusic.org. You can enjoy the Jacksonville Jazz Festival all this weekend downtown. Go to jacksonvillejazzfest.com for more. Shelton, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, and thank you to WJCT for supporting jazz music for the past 40 years.
That's right. We were long a producer of the festival. We'll close with a little live performance from the 1981 Jazz Fest, which Shelton wrote about at jacksmusic.org. This is Dizzy Gillespie and Marcus Roberts performing at the 1981 Jacksonville Jazz Festival. Enjoy.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.